The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're trying.
What about my brand name?
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at the 1993 film True Romance. Written by Quentin Tarantino and directed by Tony Scott, True Romance is chock full of A-list actors doing bad things to each other while calypso music plays for some reason. Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette play lead while Gary Oldman has dreadlocks. With me as always to discuss this film is Dr. Anthony Ledon.
Now that you've seen Gary Oldman in dreadlocks, do they appeal to you more or less?
More. Because now I'm like, oh, maybe I could pull it off. But I would have like the balding dreadlocks, which is not a look I've ever seen, where you just like have the full male pattern baldness, but then just dreadlocks hanging down.
Steve, what's your relationship with director Tony Scott?
Our relationship is almost exclusively he makes movies and I sometimes watch them.
Now, how do you like these movies?
I think it's a mixed bag.
I do not like Tony Scott.
Okay. I don't think I don't get excited about Tony Scott. And I mean, really.
What do you think of when you think about Tony Scott?
Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Beverly Hills Cop 2, Top Gun.
Sure.
I could name four or five others, but those are the ones that, after those movies, he could probably do whatever he wanted to do.
Sure.
My feeling with Tony Scott is that it's like he wants his main characters to be super handsome, super cool, super sexy, lots of fast-moving vehicles. This is a world of cool that you are entering into, and by proxy, you can be cool as well. Not my favorite film.
Right. Well, like Beverly Hills Cop 2 is significantly inferior to the original, but I also hold Beverly Hills Cop in high regard. And 2 is entertaining, and it was entertaining, especially to 11-year-old me, because it was more, more Eddie Murphy. It was Eddie Murphy with explosions and whatnot, and so there was like, whereas Beverly Hills Cop felt like a cop movie with humor, Beverly Hills Cop 2 was an Eddie Murphy movie with explosions.
Yeah, okay, so Beverly Hills Cop, Axel Foley was smarter than everyone else, and he was quicker than everyone else. He could just see a few steps ahead. It's weird to say this, but he's a little bit subdued. He's naturally funny because he's Eddie Murphy, but it's an interesting performance.
Yeah, and it's very plot driven. The characters are important, but there's a plot.
Right.
And the characters are assembled in such a way that to make this plot work. Beverly Hills Cop 2 could have been any movie in the late 80s.
Yeah, that's right.
Any cop movie, anything at all. And it could have been like, oh yeah, here's a movie. Like, oh, well, why don't we turn it into a Beverly Hills Cop 2 movie? What do we have to do? Well, yeah, just change the laugh.
So for me, True Romance is an interesting thing because it has the unmistakable Tarantino dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And sort of the concept, right? The structure, the story,
yeah.
the level of violent bombast.
Yeah, it's got the bombast. You've got the MacGuffin. You've got, you know, basically philosopher gangsters. Right. Which, you know, it's all kind of contrived, but it's got that Tarantino voice that's unmistakable. But then you give it to someone like Tony Scott, and I don't think it ruins it. It's just a different framing. It's like a Miami Vice frame. So I don't know. This is an odd movie for me because I love it, and there's a fly in the ointment for me.
Yeah, I think it's to me this feels like there is a dab of ointment on a fly.
Oh, you're flipping the metaphor on me?
Yeah, I mean, so it's an interesting thing for me to view now, because I never seen it before.
This is your first viewing.
My first viewing of it. And so I've got such a, you know, looking at it, I mean, I've probably seen as many Tony Scott movies as I've seen Tarantino movies, but I've also seen every Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you told me that, like, if watching it at the time, I'd be curious. I would probably be like, hey, you know what? This is like watching one, you know, pick any of his movies, The Last Boy Scout or Enemy of the State, yeah, or, you know, The Fan, and going, wow, this is what a movie that he makes with good dialogue is. But it'd be easy to sort of still check out.
Right.
Because he just does, I feel like he doesn't know what to do. And I can totally understand. Like, I mean, like, Tarantino probably is the most adept at handling his vision, right? I mean, that just kind of would make sense almost with anybody, right? Anybody that's a good writer that also has a good eye.
I don't know. Can I introduce you to someone named George Lucas?
Yes, of course. As you know, a blockhead is perfectly legal.
But I take your meaning. Yes, Tarantino is the best.
Well, artist. I don't think George Lucas is but I don't think he's good at either. I mean, I think George Lucas exposed himself.
Yeah.
I think the thing with Star Wars, and you and I have talked about this off air, is that those are B movies to begin with.
Yeah.
Those are B serials, and the first one is a hugely popular hit, because at the time no one had ever seen anything quite like it, but it was a space opera.
It was the best B movie that ever made. In fact, it might have retired B movies for a certain amount.
If you look at it without the frame of nostalgia and just go, well, how is this as a swashbuckling fantasy movie? Like, ooh, that might be the worst sword fight ever. Ever.
He makes up for it. I mean, in the hands of other directors, that universe was absolutely improved.
Well, exactly. So I guess the point I'm making, like, I think it actually proves my point that, like, you know, if you're a good visionary and if you're a good writer, you probably have a better way to. I think George Lucas did exactly what he should have done with what he made in Phantom Menace. I mean, like that's exactly what you deserve for that vision.
Are you brain dead?
All right. So Tony Scott. Okay. So here's how it goes down. Tarantino's struggling for about 15 years trying to break into the movie business.
I wrote a script called The Open Road. In, like, at least in handwritten pages, it was getting up to page 500, all right? But I knew after I'd written The Open Road that the next time I tried to write something, that this would be the one. And it was. The very next one I tried was True Romance. But there was also something else about True Romance that led up to it, is I was... I had tried to direct a movie, and actually, oddly enough, the movie I tried to direct was called My Best Friend's Birthday. I tried to do it on 16mm. And the scene about how I'd fuck Elvis, because that was a monologue from My Best Friend's Birthday that I said in the movie. And then what ended up happening is I put it together, and I kind of didn't have what I thought I had. It wasn't that good. And so I just decided, well, you know what? Okay, it just turned out to be nothing. But... after being depressed for like a little bit, I got over my depression. I'm pretty good about that. And I looked at the good side of it. And the good side of it was the fact that I had taught myself how to make a movie. This was my first script ever done, ever finished. So then I wrote it and then tried basically for the next 5 years to try to get it made. And it never happened. But no one was taking it. A lot of people had read this script and everything, and some people liked it, and some people didn't, actually. A lot of people actually didn't. Okay, I meet Tony. Tony reads Reservoir Dogs. He wants to do it. I say, no, I can't. I'm gonna do this. But I send him True Romance and Natural Born Killers to read, see if he wants to do those. And I really have always thought about those first three scripts I wrote. You know, they are completely my first chapter as an artist. In this industry, as an artist, my trajectory, everything, you know, the original scripts for True Romance and Natural Born Killers and Reservoir Dogs, they all three kind of fit together.
Which kind of creates something of a cinematic universe. He carves this massive script up into smaller scripts. And the two that kind of come together are True Romance and Reservoir Dogs. And Tony Scott wants to buy both of them. And what Tarantino does is that he says, you can buy one, sells True Romance for $50,000. And then with that $50,000, he decides he's going to do Reservoir Dogs himself. Now, I'm totally glad that at this stage that Tony Scott is willing to cede Tarantino. And honestly, like, you know, Reservoir Dogs is like shot. Most of the scenes are shot like in a diner in a warehouse. It's a very, very low budget movie.
Which makes the exchange much more wise, because he couldn't take $50,000
yes.
and probably do much with a True Romance.
That's right. And so at this point in Tarantino's career, this movie should be in the hands of someone like Tony Scott. I mean, listen to the cast of this thing. I mean, I don't know your feelings about Christian Slater, but Patricia Arquette, Dennis Hopper, Val Kilmer, Gary Oldman, Brad Pitt, Christopher Walken, Samuel L. Jackson, Michael Rapaport, Gandolfini, Chris Penn, Tom Sizemore. I mean, Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt's in this movie. So,
right.
There's no way.
I mean, Val Kilmer basically plays a part where you don't even really see him all that well.
Val Kilmer.
You see his finger more than anything else.
You would have no idea. You would have no idea that this was Val Kilmer if you didn't see his name at the beginning of the film. So, and there's some big set pieces in this movie. And there's some interesting camera work. And the cinematic difference between all of the Detroit scenes and then all of the L.A. scenes. Like, it just brings a different tone to the movie. So this, I think this was, even though I don't like Tony Scott usually, I think that this is, at this stage, this is what needed to happen. And then, of course, you add all of the Tarantino dialogue to these amazing actors, and this film is really quite a remarkable thing. So you saw it for the first time last night. What do you think about this movie?
I think it's fun. I was curious to see how Tarantino's writing would translate through mm-hmm. Tony Scott's lens.
Yeah.
And in that way, I was probably secondarily entertained. But it was interesting that I could not stop thinking about that almost throughout the entirety of the movie.
That's right.
It was very hard for me to dive into the world because I'm like, I don't think Tony Scott quite knows what to do with this level of grit.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Tarantino famously does, at least from my perspective, is he will bask in those moments. He will bask in the dialogue. He will let the dialogue, almost the absurd juxtaposition of dialogue to the what's going on, just stew for a while, and that creates tension. And I think that's no more apparent than the Walken Dennis Hopper exchange, because it just, it's crazy how I just, all I could think of the whole time is, man, if this was Tarantino directing it, this would feel way more tense. And it just didn't. And in some ways, I mean, obviously there's problematic dialogue in there anyway, but
I mean, it's not just the dialogue. It's problematic in any number of ways. Right. I mean, just pick away. It's not just not just the words. It's the content.
This is one of my proudest moments of my entire career. This scene. The scene actually kind of, the speech, the Sicilian speech came about in real life through two friends. One was, we're kind of badass older black guy that was kind of like, there's my mom, and then her best friend was a woman named Jackie, and she was black, and she was like my second mom, kind of, you know, all, you know, through my entire childhood and teenage years. And she had a brother who was no longer with us anymore, who had spent some time in jail, and his name was Don, Big D was actually his most commonly used nickname. And Big D has shown up in a lot of my movies. Sam Jackson's little bit that mostly got cut out by the MPAA in the opening scene with Dretzel, he's playing Big D. That's his, if you read the script, that's his character's name is Big D. And he used to tell me about history and stuff. And he told me way back when, all right, like literally when I was about like, you know, 10 or 11 or something like that, about how the Moors conquered Sicily and how the Moors were black and they started fucking the Sicilian women. And that's why Sicilians look the way they do today.
It's Christopher Walken playing a Sicilian, which...
Sure.
Which, in the scene, calling out that Sicilians have dark skin, Christopher Walken does not.
Ghost white Christopher Walken. Yeah, so, but I mean, what I'm saying is that, like, if that had been directed by Tarantino, I think the uncomfortability of the language and the concept and would have not necessarily been forgiven, but I think it would have maybe added to the tension and the discomfort of that scene. And so the scene just becomes kind of uncomfortable because it just feels like I don't think he knows what to do with this script. I mean, I think he's moving it along from a narrative perspective and like just kind of moving the plot along. But I didn't feel like he knew how to wait in certain scenes and let the absurdity of the dialogue or the notion do its thing, right? Because I just felt like it's way more Tony Scott than Tarantino, in my opinion.
And I mean, you might change your tune on this if you watch it a few more times. But I, you know, we just recently redid Pulp Fiction, right?
Right.
Just thinking, several times in Pulp Fiction, there's this appreciation of the pause. You know, there will be a dialogue, and then there'll be a long pause. And it's almost like Tarantino allows these actors to kind of make a meal out of the moment. And this, you know, Tony Scott's fast pace and you know, big colors and big lights and camera angles and smoke and steam and, you know, machines. That's not really Tarantino's thing. And so a scene like that, which I kind of felt like I could hear the Tarantino bleeding through that scene, maybe more so. That scene, I thought, I hear Tarantino's voice in this scene maybe more than any other scene. But your point, which is well taken, is that it would certainly have felt different if it was Tarantino.
Yeah. And like I said, I think it was a matter of like, wow, this script is amazing. This dialogue is amazing. And Tony Scott's like, let's see what happens. and I just didn't feel like he was sinister enough for the scenes that required that. So I feel like the bombast moments were just sort of like not as bombastic as one might expect considering all that's going on. And it's a lot of crazy stuff's going on. There's no question about it.
No, I don't have a long history with this movie either. I only saw it for the first time a few years ago. And I feel like half of my enjoyment is that sort of metacritical aspect where I'm thinking that scene right there gets retooled or reframed and put in Pulp Fiction. Or, oh, I can see how that led to this scene in Kill Bill. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like you see a lot of the Tarantino DNA in this movie. And it's almost like it's like the batter. It's like the batter of a really good cake. It's like it's not baked. It's, you know, the batter is a different experience than the cake. But, you know, it's a good, you know, licking the bowl is fun sometimes.
Yeah, but as you eat the cake, you go, man, I kind of wish I would just lick the bowl.
So I feel like I don't know what I would have felt like if I had seen this movie first.
I think this is like for people who don't like coffee, but they love the way coffee smells.
Yeah, I could see that. Now, I do feel like there are a few scenes in this movie that are singular. Have you ever seen Gary Oldman? Have you ever seen a character like Gary Oldman's character?
Gary Oldman is incredible. I want to see a movie where it's Gary Oldman and Val Kilmer's Ghost of Elvis. Just, I don't even care what they're doing. I don't care if they're playing Atari.
Drexel Spivey playing a pimp. But also, you know, he's dabbling in a lot of things.
A little bit of cultural appropriation. Yeah.
A lot of. I mean, this is the guy that did Dracula. This is the guy that played Winston Churchill. He was a
hard, Beethoven, I believe.
A hard-boiled detective in Batman. You're a Gary Oldman guy.
Gary Oldman can do whatever he wants, and he does. He walked in to read at True Romance, and they just said, pick a character. It's yours. I don't even care. They had to talk him out of playing Alabama.
I'm Alabama.
Now, as someone who likes Gary Oldman, and having never seen this movie, I just want to get that sort of visceral reaction.
Oh, what a treat. I mean, I was immediately like, okay, now we're cooking. And then I'm like, oh, man, I would. And then I had that moment where I'm like, kind of would have loved to have seen Tarantino direct Gary Oldman in this role.
I mean, look, if it was Tarantino, then Sam Jackson would have been in the role instead of being killed within 30 seconds of him coming in the room.
Sam Jackson would have been the Sicilian. Let's be honest.
I love this movie has so many small parts that are just like you want to see a whole movie.
Mostly small parts.
Oh, you want to see a whole movie of all of the bit players in this film.
Yeah, it's wild how it attracted such big names.
So I guess Apatow decided to create Pineapple Express basically entirely on the Brad Pitt character in this movie.
Oh, is that right?
He thought, well, what if Brad Pitt actually went after the Italians after they left the room? And that was sort of the seed of Pineapple Express. To me, it's amazing that Brad Pitt isn't in the Christian Slater role.
Right.
But I kind of like Christian Slater in this, and I kind of like Brad Pitt doing what Brad Pitt does in this movie.
Hey, get some beer and some cleaning products.
I love Tarantino's dialogue. I do sometimes find that I don't need his voice in every character. And what I mean by that is that it's almost every room you go in, someone's got a very strong opinion, a very considered point of view, and a perfect monologue to deliver on that particular point. And what I'm missing in Tarantino's movies are characters like Brad Pitt. Like, this guy is just baked. There's no more There's nothing more to him. You don't need to know anything else. His brain is baked. And you need an actor to deliver that guy well. And it to me, it's just perfect that it's Brad Pitt. And I don't know, in retrospect, it's kind of funny because he's like become A-list movie star. At this point in time, he was the perfect stoner. And I can't imagine that performance being loquacious. So that is my little monologue on Brad Pitt.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I mean, there are like, I think in Pulp Fiction at the drug house, you have the little moments of that, I think, with Rosanna Arquette. I think you get little glimpses of some of those types of characters, but you're right. I mean, I think there's so much that he wants to have said that everybody gets a chance to say something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. James Gandolfini. Now, I am not a Sopranos guy, so I've only seen a few episodes of The Sopranos. Culturally, I know all about The Sopranos because I've heard people talk about The Sopranos, but I don't really view Gandolfini through that lens. But just getting this little snippet of Gandolfini in this movie, I can't look away. This guy is just, he's like a beacon of evil.
Yeah, he does a lot to bring the, like I said, some of that sinister patience. And I don't know if that's like maybe almost, sometimes you almost wonder, like, does a performance force the director's hand? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it's such a uncomfortable and brutal scene anyway. Like, I think some of the issues I have is, like, the cutaways back to Christian Slater. And, like, you're kind of like, oh, I hope he gets there in time kind of thing. It just didn't, I don't feel like that was paced well.
Wait, let's talk about that for just a minute. Patricia Arquette is being brutally beaten on her way to being murdered.
Mm-hmm.
By a guy that I just described as a beacon of evil. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Christian Slater is talking to a complete stranger about a magazine article about Elvis Presley.
Where he criticizes the fans.
That didn't work for you?
No, and that's the thing is like, that was supposed to work better because there was a lot there that was like, ah, this is great, but it's not. It was a pacing issue. Because I think you should stay in those moments even longer, mm-hmm. so that way you almost. Because I think Tarantino would have gotten you to kind of almost forget what was going on in the hotel.
Hmm.
Like he would draw you into that other side. Mm-hmm. This feels like a Tarantino appreciation podcast at this point, but like I feel like
it's true.
There's that, and I think there's also a Tony Scott. I don't appreciate part of this podcast, right? Where I think if they had taken time where like also now you're into this conversation, he'd almost trick you into forgetting and then boom, bring you right back into that world. And you'd be like, oh man, you know, so I just think that there were opportunities.
Let's set this
aside.
I think
that's what it's supposed to be laid out, right? Uh-huh. It's supposed to be this like not only is it supposed to be tense, but like, this is what's going on instead. I mean, ordering giant chili burgers and chili fries and a Diet Coke.
So let's set that scene aside, Kill Bill Volume 2. Daryl Hannah is about to buy a Hanzo sword for $1 million. And in the briefcase is a Black Mamba. And when dude opens up, what's his name again? Dang it, Bill's brother.
Bud.
Bud, yeah. When Bud opens up the briefcase, Black Mamba bites him in the face.
Bud, I'd like to introduce my friend, the Black Mamba.
Black Mamba?
This is Bud. You know, before I picked that little fella up, I looked him up on the internet. Fascinating creature, the Black Mamba. Listen to this. In Africa, the saying goes, in the bush, an elephant can kill you, a leopard can kill you, and a Black Mamba can kill you. But only with the Mamba, and this has been true in Africa since the dawn of time, is death sure. Hence its handle, Death Incarnate. Pretty cool, huh? Its neurotoxic venom is one of nature's most effective poisons, acting on the nervous system, causing paralysis. The venom of a black mamba can kill a human being in 4 hours, if, say, bitten on the ankle or the thumb. However, a bite to the face or torso can bring death from paralysis within 20 minutes. Now, you should listen to this, because this concerns you. The amount of venom that can be delivered from a single bite can be gargantuan. You know, I've always liked that word, gargantuan. I so rarely have an opportunity.
It's all very calmly delivered while the person is on the floor. So that scene is absolutely the same scene with Gandolfini after he's just beat up Patricia Arquette. But what the Kill Bill scene doesn't have is it doesn't have the cutaways.
Right.
For whatever reason, it just feels like the Tarantino scene is just that much more patient and significantly better in my mind.
Yes, I agree.
Now, I will say that I don't think it ruins Gandolfini's performance.
No. And I think, like I said, I think that's great. The performance is great. That scene is great. And he's got these two scenes that he's shooting independently of each other. And then it's how he decides to put them together to build up the tension. So I wanted that, the juxtaposition of like, if there's an intentional point to have Christian Slater be doing frivolous things while something terrible is happening at the same time. And so in order for that frivolous thing to feel even more tense, and I think it, the way that it's written is probably to do that kind of trick where you're like getting caught up in this other frivolous world that you're like, no, I don't, like, you got to hurry up. But at the same time, it's like, there should be moments where you like all of a sudden get kind of like lulled into it. That's just my thought. Mm-hmm.
Let's have the Slater conversation. Is he good in this movie?
Yeah. I think Heather would disagree. I don't think she found him very compelling as this character. I think he's good at parts and not at others, and I don't know what to put that on. Because I really did think it was I really bought him early. So then when he goes and he confronts Drexel, I'm like, whoa, that's quite the shift. So I felt like there was a certain sociopathy that he's obviously demonstrating, but like sometimes it seemed like he was flatter than I would have liked to have seen in other scenes.
I mean, this guy, he's a wannabe Elvis. I mean, he loves Elvis so much that his psyche is Elvis. Like, whenever he's looking in the mirror talking to himself, it's Elvis's voice talking back to him. Like, is he crazy?
Right.
Or is this, is this just a quirky bit of filmmaking to kind of give us a different perspective on what's going on in his head? So,
Well, he seems to be interacting to some degree, right?
The film is trying to tell me that this guy is super cool, and yet I'm thinking no, he's wannabe Elvis. He works at a comic shop and wants to take this poor woman to 3 kung fu movies.
Right.
What is your feeling about Christian Slater kind of as a whole?
So I don't have a lot of, like, I know he's done like some stuff kind of lately, like Really Bad Things, right? Wasn't that one he was in? I always kind of felt like Christian Slater was close to being somebody that I would be interested in. Like, he was the it guy for a minute.
For a minute, he was. He was like, he's going to be the next Jack Nicholson.
Whether you like it or not, he's going to force it on you. And so, like, so there was a lot of talk about. So the same way that kind of people talk about Keanu Reeves as sort of being like one dimensional. It's like I feel more that way probably about Christian Slater than I think I do about Keanu, even though I know why people say that about Keanu. Because I just feel like, because he does seem like he's a bit more of a persona, maybe. Like, I can't tell. It's like, are you really this slick and all the time? Or, and then when I see him try to go off type, it feels like it doesn't work. I'm like, well, maybe that is who he is.
See, I feel like with this movie, you could probably slot in 10 different actors. We could probably name 10 different actors to slot into this, and they would all work just fine. I don't think anyone, just anyone, could pull off this role. I don't think he's bad in this movie. I think it actually kind of works with him in this movie. But I don't think I don't think this movie needs Slater in the same way that Pulp Fiction needs Travolta. But I don't think he makes the movie worse.
I don't know that he does. I think he's a neutral, which maybe in its own way is a criticism. Because wouldn't you want somebody to make you, I don't know, make you feel more compelled every time they come into the room?
Hmm.
I just felt it was, to me, it was one of those things where you're like, anytime they interact, yeah, like he would interact with somebody who was clearly a higher, profile actor, is like, it seemed a little bit more like jarring from a juxtaposition standpoint.
So the way I view this movie is that this is Tarantino, and he's talked about this. This is Tarantino. He doesn't have really any experience of women. He doesn't really know what women are like. He's this dorky guy working at a video store. And this is kind of wish fulfillment. Like, he longs to be cool, but he's just the least cool guy ever. And so everything he knows about cool, he's learned from watching movies.
And I mean, it's funny because, like, none of this stuff happened to me. All right. I never met some, cool hooker or pretty much any girl around that time. Not at the time I wrote this anyway. And that's part of this movie, all right, is the fact that I was 25 and I really never had a girlfriend.
And so what happens here is, like, his little fantasy. It's like, I work at a comic shop, but my boss hires a call girl to do some sort of improbable meet cute at a movie theater. She likes kung fu movies. She watches 3 movies with me. We make love, but then she falls in love with me. This is all just absurd. The whole thing is absurd. But it's almost like Tarantino is about to turn his nerdiness into a sort of auteur filmmaking career. So I almost forgive the nerdiness because I know what it's going to become later. So I don't know. This film is really dorky. It's really unlikely. It's totally ridiculous at times. But I think it's a fun ride. I like it.
It does, especially if I'd seen it real time, it would feel like a little bit of a gateway, right, into the world of Tarantino. Mm-hmm. And this stuff is happening, right? Because you've got Natural Born Killers, and you've got this anti-hero thing kind of on the rise. Mm-hmm, it feels like. Mm-hmm.
And Natural Born Killers, and I think you see the DNA of that in this movie too, right?
Sure.
Again, another movie that Tarantino wrote and then was completely rewritten. This movie was basically Tarantino's movie, except in the original screenplay, Christian Slater dies. He dies at the drug house shootout. So would you have liked this movie better if he, lives hard, lives fast, and leaves a beautiful corpse at the end?
For this movie, okay, maybe for his movie, but for this Tony Scott movie, I think it was fine that he lived. At least it then explained the obnoxious island music.
I was going to just say, the Hans Zimmer...
You're so cool.
Steel drums.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like, oh my gosh, there's no way that would be in a Tarantino film. But then, of course... when you get to that last scene on the beach, you realize, oh, okay, that's what's going on here.
Well, I kind of knew that like immediately. I'm like, oh, this is not cute or clever enough to just have this juxtaposition. It's got to be like a foreshadowing. So then I kind of got that sense. Mm-hmm. And then when it happens, you're like, yeah, we're fine.
Is there a trope, a cliche, or a device in this movie that you enjoyed?
The Tarantino stuff.
That's not a trope.
He's all trope.
I like when there's a shootout and at least 10 bottles of high-end liquor get blown away. And it works every time. It works every time. I want to know how you felt about Saul Rubinek.
I liked Saul Rubinek.
You did?
Oh yeah. Actually, anything with Pinchot, I mean, he was great, by the way.
Pinchot was amazing.
Pinchot's so good in this movie.
And he's also in Beverly Hills Cop, right?
Right. But not too.
Like legitimately fantastic.
Yeah, very convincing. Had some
the range on this guy.
Good acting chops in this, right? Like there's some comedy. There's a lot of comedy, right? I mean, a lot of like funny stuff, but he doesn't like he performs very well in other scenes where it's a little more dramatic. And
like he's legitimately kind of big timing Christian Slater. Like I'm a big deal and you're not, mm-hmm. right? And yet you put him in the room with Rubinek. And he's believably a lackey, right? You put him in the car with cocaine all over his face.
Well, he's throwing up after a roller coaster.
I mean, I'm kind of amazed. Like, looking back, I'm kind of amazed at this guy. I'm kind of surprised that after this role, he didn't have a lot of other opportunities.
Yeah.
Are we just like overlooking the shadow that Balki Bartokomos casts over this guy's career?
Yeah, possibly, right? Because I think, I mean, since I didn't see it at the time, I wonder if it would have been like hard for me to be like, that's Balki.
Yeah, you probably would have.
You know, like would it have felt like stunt casting?
But if you, let's just eliminate Perfect Strangers from the equation. You walk out of Beverly Hills Cop. And then you walk into this movie, you're thinking, what can this guy not do?
Right.
This guy is amazing.
Yeah.
So Bronson Pinchot, a tip of the hat to you, sir. Fantastic. You know who else was fantastic in this movie? Chris Penn.
Oh, yeah.
Legitimately funny.
Very good.
Like, just legitimately funny in an understated way. I could watch an entire... I would watch 4 buddy cop movies with Tom Sizemore and Chris Penn.
Totally.
Those guys had immediate chemistry. I love those two guys.
I wonder if Bronson Pinchot... Because Perfect Strangers goes to 93. This movie comes out in 93. Did the movie Second Sight with John Larroquette just absolutely destroy any possibility that he could have like a major role?
Never saw Second Sight.
Where Bronson Pinchot is the psychic that's helping John Larroquette. I believe he's like a private eye or something, so trying to solve a crime.
I know what I'm going to be watching tonight. Sounds amazing.
Oh, I remember this. Remember the trailer for this very specifically.
Patricia Arquette. did we need this amount of cleavage? Now, this is one of those things, like, I don't know if Tarantino would have done this differently, but Tony Scott, it's like almost every shot is shooting right down her bra.
Well, probably the script was all like feet shots, and he was like, what am I doing with this?
He didn't know what to make of it. Why do I care about her feet again? what do you think about her in this film?
I think she's good. I think she's very good. Like, I think, I mean, even my like critique of maybe Christian Slater might be a little bit little too much, but I think so. I think she's very good. I don't think I have a ton of Patricia Arquette, history in terms of like.
You've seen all of her work in Severance.
I have seen all of her work in Severance. A lot of, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, sure. But there's a lot of movies of hers that I just haven't seen.
You know, it's weird. This is one of those movies where it's like I'll just watch this scene for the Chris Walken stuff, or I'll just watch this scene for the Gary Oldman stuff, or I'll just watch this for the Bronson Pinchot stuff. I'll watch this for the Gandolfini stuff. It's like, I kind of feel like the Slater and Arquette relationship is the least interesting thing about this movie.
I could see that.
And those two are just kind of a vehicle to get you to all of these more interesting characters. Like, I love the Brad Pitt stuff. So I wonder, like, if you were to do something like, you know, if this was Travolta and Uma Thurman driving this, what it would be like.
Right. And again, I'm not even necessarily sure that it's because Slater and Arquette weren't up to the task so much as it is the movie was designed and directed in such a way that it didn't emphasize that. Because maybe it was so enamored with this other world and so enamored with these bit characters and sort of the ridiculous juxtaposition of this world versus what's really going on and how intense it is that it kind of missed the point of like, well, you should also make the main parts of this, the stars or the main characters compelling enough to where, you don't necessarily want to lose sight of it. Because, like, how many times did I want to, like, follow Brad Pitt as opposed to Christian Slater? And that's crazy with how little Brad Pitt's doing.
Have you ever seen Michael Rapaport in anything that you didn't like?
That's a good question.
Like, he's always playing that guy.
Right.
He's always playing that guy. And I love that guy. He's absolutely immediately the guy that you want to have a beer with.
Did you ever see the one movie where he's like kind of like a make-believe superhero?
No.
Gosh, I gotta remember that. It's an interesting, I don't know that it's...
And this is not Hero at Large? This is something different than
No, no. No, no, not Hero at Large. Now I'm wondering if I'm... it's called Special.
And it's not Hero at Large.
No, it's about a guy who signs up for an experimental antidepressant, and so like, I think he starts to believe he has superpowers, and he doesn't know, and so you don't know if he does or not, if he's kind of going a little nuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's odd.
All right, I'll watch it.
I mean, that's I like how I sold you on it. It's odd. You're like, oh, I'll watch it.
No, you got me. You got me. I'm interested. I've never seen him in a movie that I didn't immediately want to hang out with him. he's fantastic. Is there a tweak that you would make to this movie to improve it?
Yeah, I think we know that. Or just maybe not.
I know what you're going to say. You can't say that. You can say something else.
I didn't love Christian Slater's hair.
You didn't like the dyed flat top.
It was a little too long in the back.
Why not give him Elvis's hair?
right? And he's got the glasses. In fact, you let one of the Italian killers has Elvis's hair.
Uh huh. I've never seen a movie that I liked Dennis Hopper in.
Is that right?
I liked him in this one.
So you don't? Do you not like Dennis Hopper, or do you just he just happens to be in movies you don't like?
I like Easy Rider. I thought that was fine. I wasn't a huge fan of Waterworld.
Oh, really?
I'm the only one.
I know, hot take. I'm the on
only
the
one that didn't like
properly
it.
Properly Howard podcast. My gosh, how'd you feel about Geely and Ishtar while we're getting to these hot takes?
Yeah, this is the only one. And it was a small part. And I thought he was pretty great. In fact, he almost looks like Christian Slater's dad, and delivers an incredibly racist monologue. for some reason, I'm like, I'm buying it. I totally. This guy seems like a former cop in Detroit who now lives in a motorhome right by a railroad track. I totally believe this guy. So,
you didn't like him in Speed?
I never liked Speed, and I know that this is a point of consternation. I'm not a big Sandra Bullock fan, and you know my feelings of Keanu. This sort of was the era of Keanu that I just don't really appreciate. I don't like the premise of the movie. I don't like the stunts.
Man.
I don't care
what our next season's theme is, but Speed's a top pick for me.
All right. I'm going to reveal something to you now that I don't know if I've told you before. I'm not a big action movie guy. I don't really like a lot of action films.
You like superhero movies?
I love superhero
movies. Do you? Okay. Maybe you don't know what the word action means.
There's not a lot that I like. I like action movies that incorporate science fiction. How's that? Like, I like T2. I like Alien.
You think, well, okay. I mean, the bus can't slow down. Otherwise, a bomb will go off.
I get that part of it. Like, that part I understand.
Have you ever driven in traffic?
I've driven.
You ever feel late to be somewhere and you're like, man, I don't know what to do. And like, if your life depended on it.
Maybe that's why I don't like Speed. Too much anxiety. I will rewatch it for you. But I'm just telling you that I hated that movie when I first saw it.
I don't remember liking it or disliking it when I first saw it. I rewatched it not too long ago, and both Heather and I were kind of both surprised at how much we enjoyed it. So if anybody takes anything away from this podcast review of True Romance, I'm going to say, well, give Speed another shot.
Is there anything else you want to say about True Romance, Steve?
I don't think so. It's just, I mean, again, I think I will watch it again. I think there's a lot of ingredients in this cake that I should like. And so I think that's why I like, you know, because like, here's the thing, man. I'll eat a bad cake.
This movie to me is like one time a friend of mine put scrambled eggs on pizza.
Mm.
And I like scrambled eggs and I like pizza. And I am an adventurous eater. I'll try new things. So I was like, all right, I'll give this a go. And you know what it tasted like? It tasted like someone put scrambled eggs on pizza.
Mm.
And that wasn't my favorite.
Well, and that makes sense, right? Because like some things you put together and you're like, well, that just changes the dynamic of both things. But but I could see why I'd be like, I have a pizza. I probably would rather. Like, I feel this. Look, since we're in true confession mode, I just root beer floats don't do a damn thing for me.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan.
I mean.
But I don't like root beer.
See, I like root beer. I like ice cream. You know what would be great? Those two things separate. I don't want to make each thing worse. Ice cream's too wet. Root beer's too gooey.
Here's the thing about this movie is that I'm sure that you'll at times think, like, I'd like to pull up the Gary Oldman stuff on YouTube just so I can watch him. And then at other times you'll think, maybe I want to just watch Brad Pitt again. Or maybe I just want to watch Gandolfini again. And then what you'll realize is that you're watching so many different little bits of this film that there's no reason why you shouldn't just sit down and watch the whole
thing. That's fair. Then you watch it and you go, oh, that I've been skipping over these other parts maybe intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Michael Rapaport's T.J. Hooker read is amazing, by the way.
Number one, I love that it's T.J. Hooker.
The new T.J. Hooker. He says the new T.J. Hooker.
He makes it clear. But then immediately, and this is just beautiful Tarantino dialogue. He's like, oh, you get to meet Captain Kirk. That's exactly how that conversation would go.
Right.
It doesn't matter that he's Bill Shatner. It matters that you are in the same room as Captain Kirk.
Totally.
And so who cares that it's TJ? Who cares that if it's the new TJ Hooker? I love that performance got him the part.
Right. Because that's the other little fun part of that.
Without even a callback. Didn't need a callback.
And it looked like he was obviously getting ushered out of it. And you just go, man, how much worse was the rest of the reads?
It was Shatner. Shatner was watching it. He's like, there's something about that guy. I think that I can pull something out of that guy. You know what? I would love to see a sequel to this movie. And I don't see why that couldn't be done. Like, there's a lot of characters in this movie. I'd love to see it in a different movie. Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard movie?
I was tempted to go properly Howard.
It's just so unlike any Ron Howard movie.
It is, but...
Does it feel weird to say properly Howard when the film itself is so different than
Ron? Right, and I think that's where I'm at. Is like, because I think I feel like that same kind of like, I liked it. A lot of great actors doing a lot of great things. But could they have done something a little bit more different? Could they have maybe just tweaked it to be more edgy, or, you know what I mean? So I feel like from a straight up movie standpoint, it's very off the Howard trail, but in terms of how I feel, and that's what this podcast is about, I feel it is properly Howard. Mm.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna say this is Howard plus two. I mean, I think that I think I gave Pulp Fiction a Howard plus 12.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the reason why I like Pulp Fiction is because of the dialogue.
Fair.
And so I feel like, no, it wasn't the perfect movie. Maybe, you know, maybe in the hands of someone else. Maybe if you gave, like, Tarantino dialogue to Scorsese, it would feel different. And there's no question in my mind that if you gave Tarantino's script to Martin Scorsese, that would be a much better movie than this one.
Sure.
But to drop from Howard plus 12 to Howard properly Howard for this film seems a big drop, given how much fun I had watching gotcha. This movie. So I'm going to say Howard plus two on this one.
Okay.
And you know what? I'm going to call an audible here. I'm going to suggest we do Hero at Large next.
Wow. Yeah, this is the only logical next step after True Romance is Hero at Large.
I can't explain why, but I will say this. We're watching it at some point this season.
So why not now?
Why not do it right after True Romance? Again, never seen it. Very curious.
Me neither.
All I know about this is that it's got the guy from Three's Company who's pretending to be a superhero, and he spends some time in a bathtub. That's the whole thing I know about it.
Gonna get wet.
Steve, does True Romance have a one to grow on half the battle moment?
I'd say, like, maybe prolong the courtship.
Don't get married in less than 24 hours to the call girl.
To the prostitute that was hired.
I'm looking at her perspective. Don't get married within 24 hours to the guy who lives in Detroit, hangs out on a billboard, and works a comic shop.
Also, maybe one other thing is if you've thrown up on your sweater, feel free to not have it around your neck anymore.
Cocoon of horror.